In The Spiritual Illusion, Jonathan Herman wishes to initiate a discussion of the feasibility of the category spirituality within the study of religions. This response addresses several methodological problems with his effort and questions the feasibility of his ironic approach. My critique is fivefolded. Firstly, Herman draws a crude picture of the relationship between theology and the study of religion. Secondly, he does not explain why his sample of authors constitutes a hegemony for the understanding of spirituality in the study of religions. Thirdly, he ignores those who have been influential for how the category is used today. Fourthly, religion is assumed to be a rectified category not worthy of discussion. And fifthly, it remains unclear where where an ironic and imaginative comparison of spiritual and religion and penis and vagina takes us. This was the peak of my academic career. This abstract.
Well, it was a little dense right up till the last, and then it took an unexpected turn.
Rather.
In what way was this the peak of your academic career?
I think it's the only publication I have in international, at least within my field, renowned journal.
Congratulations.
Humble brag.
Hey, well, if this is not the episode for that, when is it?
And in that, I deal with the comparison another scholar made between religion, spirituality, and penis and vagina.
That sounds like a very fancy way of saying he started it.
Yeah, but he did.
We should leave the academic pissing contest stuff for next week's episode, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Well, this was still within the academy.
Yeah, but academic pissing contest, I'm going to file under things that are wrong.
I thought that the academy was all about the pissing contests. Isn't that what furthers science?
Should we give this episode some context?
This is the second installment in the tale about the academy and the host of Small Differences.
And how we got to be this way, TM.
Ruined.
Former academics.
Right. Last time we talked about the path, the circumstances that led us to university, and now we have enrolled, we have entered, we are a bit in.
Yeah.
Brett. And how does that look like?
Well, I guess to start with, you have this lovely experience of, if you like, learning environments anyway, lovely experience of being awash in new information, which is interesting. And I guess the further you go through undergraduate studies, right, the more license you get to explore the things that you think are interesting. And so that's a pretty exciting thing. If you like learning at all, then that's pretty exciting. I mean, I'm not saying there aren't universities and lecturers and people like that who can hammer the living shit out of the interestingness of what you're trying to achieve. But in theory, there is interesting material in there, and that's a delightful experience. So for me, my 4 years of undergraduate was really super interesting. Like, I had a lot of sort of stuff going on in my own time as well, but it was, I really liked learning about psychology and about the brain, especially. I majored and mostly ended up sort of picking subjects towards the end that were more neuroscience focused and cognitive psychology focused, because I was really interested in how this all actually works as a bag of meat.
And I guess studying university, you have this kind of intellectual honeymoon, which is both a bit daunting, but also, yeah, just this is so cool that we can do this.
When you say that we can do this, do you mean we as a society are able to produce all this knowledge, or you personally are able to just roll in it?
Well, that the society thing sounded way better.
Okay, sure, that, yeah.
But from an individual experience, I guess.
What did you, I don't know, like you started the episode with talking about your peak academic achievement, but like what did that look like at undergraduate level? What do you remember as being the kind of defining moment?
I think that's perhaps jumping a bit too far into it, because I could... It's weird, because while I obviously from early stage imagined myself to be an academic, it also seemed so impossible in a way.
Why?
Because you knew that the path was hard. It was difficult to get into the PhD program and so on. Yeah.
So even as an undergraduate, you're thinking, I want to do this for a living. I want to get a PhD. I want to wrestle ideas for a living.
Yeah, I did. And that was partly what went into the decision to not steer towards a career in World of Warcraft as mage, or I don't remember. I think I was a paladin, actually. That was the most boring class.
It's highly appropriate for someone who then went on to study religion.
You would think. I think theology would have been better suited. A paladin.
Okay. So what happened? How did we get deeper into the academy? Because like lots of people go to university now, right? Lots of people do their 3 or 4 years. And they're largely untouched by it. They come out the other end, they have a piece of paper. What makes the difference?
I think what happened, well, as a sciencey person, you know that it is a factor of many variables, circumstances, and chance. So,
right.
Chance, as you say. But
I say what?
but I think it was mainly because of my closest friends, and also the department was... Yeah, the staff and the professor, they had a thing going on, sort of.
It
was productive.
Well, that
inspiring.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, that kind of thing. So when, for example, when I found the Gospel of Judas, professors at our department were sort of one of the, or among the first who got to translate it and so on. So it felt kind of important. Or,
right. You felt like you were on the cutting edge somewhere.
Something like that, yeah.
Hmm. I can relate to that. The department where I was an undergraduate, when I was about third year, maybe before I started my fourth year, got some electroencephalograph equipment, EEG stuff, that you could put a kind of fancy looking hairnet on people and you could measure electrical transmission happening in the brain and try and infer from that what might be going on beneath. Now, actually, it's really complicated because what happens on the surface of the brain, it's not necessarily representative of which bits are being involved or what's happening where, but it's kind of a first step.
So at which stage did you guys put a salmon into this machine?
Different machine. That's an MRI. does a wholly different thing.
No fish?
No fish. We had no fish. There were no fish, yes, in my undergraduate career, I'm sorry to say. But I was completely hooked. I was just completely compelled by the idea that you could measure brain activity in real time, more or less, even if it was a kind of a very weird approximation of what was happening. So, yeah, the fact that this was there at all was exciting.
Yeah, usually we have no idea if there's any activity going on in the brains, right?
Well, sometimes the lights are on, but it's not clear if anyone's actually home, sure.
But Was this as an undergraduate? Did you have access to this kind of equipment?
Or? I wanted to have access for my final year project, and it was just too much to do in a short time. It wasn't practical, unfortunately. So I had to infer hemispheric activity, that is what was happening in the two different halves of the brain, and whether it was happening any differently through behavioral measures, which is to say how long people took to do stuff. I didn't have a chance at that point to get my hands dirty with this, even though I really, really wanted to.
So what kind of stuff did you do? Was it lab work or mainly reading or...?
We had quite a lot of lectures. The way that psychology is taught in the UK is you're teaching a fairly prescribed curriculum for a good chunk of the degree, because there is a governing body who basically says what the curriculum must include. And then anything else is dependent, like anywhere, I assume anything else is dependent on the sort of interests of the members of staff who teach. So we did some labs. Increasingly, we sort of ran small studies and wrote them up. That's kind of very bad lab reports, I'm sure they were pretty terrible. And then in final year, we had to sort of run our own study and write it up, which is still pretty much what undergraduate psychology students do. What about you? Mostly reading? What did you produce? Like, did you have a thesis that you wrote for your final year, or what happened?
So our bachelor degree it's done in 3 years, and you will have, I guess, one sort of area which you specialize in, and you have some optional or some subjects you just can choose, whatever. The final year you have to write a thesis. It's not very long. It's like 5,000 words or something.
Mm. That seems like a lot when you're an undergraduate, I imagine.
Yeah, especially when you have to do it the last night before you have to the deadline.
Yeah, I've never done that. I don't know about you. Never. Constantly.
You are what's the English word? I guess this is my word of the week in Norwegian.
Okay, what's the word?
Skippertak, eller skippertaksmetoden.
I've never come across that.
That's surprising.
I want it to be something about a tarpaulin, but ship like ship, talk like talk like roof,
as in as a captain of a ship or something.
I got nothing. What is it?
If you Google translate it, it's out effort, which is an expression I never heard before.
Me neither. Can you talk around it?
So skippertak, it's pretty much the methodology of doing things last minute.
Just in time.
Not just in time, but doing a whole bunch the last minute.
A procrastinator.
Yeah, it's very much in the procrastination. Yeah.
Okay. Is it negative? Does it have negative connotations?
Yes, somewhat. It's a bit. It has become accepted now more and more.
Okay. Like, there's a whole. The phrase, I'm just thinking about the phrase, premature optimization. Like, there's sometimes an argument to be made for not making decisions or not doing stuff sooner. I'm not sure it's the case when you've got an essay due and you've known that for 2 months and you only write it the day before. But there are some circumstances under which it seems sensible to just wait and see.
But there's the thing, because I think I wrote most of my bachelor thesis the last week, and mostly the two last days before the deadline. But I had thought about it. I had read much. I had discussed it for a pretty long while. So I think we We often think of just the writing as the work, but there's lots of work before that.
Right.
And thinking through it and talking about it and so on.
Right.
So when you are in that kind of mode, I think it's okay, actually, to get it out the last minute. This is my method now for preparation for talks. I usually will prepare the talk, like write notes the day before or the night before, or even perhaps the morning.
Yeah. It drives me insane when people say, oh, are you coming to talk at whatever? Send us your slides a month in advance. And I'm like, I don't know what I think about this thing yet. Even if I wrote down today what I think about this, it's going to mature. It's going to change. I need to change the slides at the last minute because I will have new thoughts. It's an evolving process.
I have a life hack for that.
I can't remember what it is. I've seen it and I can't remember what you wrote.
Don't use slides.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. And that's fine.
It's so freeing.
Yeah, it's troublesome if you actually want to present visual information, which is kind of a big part of my shtick. Look at this thing. Let's talk about it. Look at this other thing. Let's talk about that. You talk about ideas. I talk about things people need to look at.
Yeah, concrete things. Well, I think still you don't need the slides in the order and so on.
They don't need the slides. They're going to have no words. This is the other thing. They're like, oh, we want to print them out so people can read the notes while you're speaking. And I'm like, A, that's one of the dumbest things you can ever do, backed up by research. So this is not irrelevant. This is not an irrelevant rant at all. This is what I ended up doing in academia, is researching this nonsense. And B, there's no words on the slides. Knock yourselves out. Good luck with that. Good luck reading the slides in advance. It's just some pictures. Sorry, soapbox.
I'm tempted to pivot this episode into the whole rant about PowerPoint, but I guess that wasn't what people tuned in for.
No, we've kind of broken with our format a little, so maybe we should like do that only one layer deep.
Yeah, but so many slides throughout
The conferences. 20 lines of 10-point font. I am the person who sits and counts.
But at least you have something to do.
Indeed. Back on track. Desperately trying to get this conversation back on track.
Yeah. Did your sort of curricula, your education consists? You mentioned last time that you have physics and chemistry.
Right.
But
and maths.
And maths. And math? Mathematics, maths?
Maths in the UK, math in the US.
Hmm. But did you have any sort of odd subjects or something else?
At university?
Yeah.
Well, this is the really crippling thing about choosing to study psychology when it's so strictly policed what the curriculum is that it leaves very, very little room for interpretation. The first 2 years I had a bit more. I should probably say I went to university in Scotland, which is a four-year degree. If I'd gone to England, it would have been three. So there are people listening to this wondering why I did a four-year degree. It's because I was in Scotland. So what I managed to do in my first and second year, in my first year, I took maths and physics because psychology was only one subject and it was only one third of the curriculum. In my second year, I got to take anatomy and physiology and biology simultaneously. And the anatomy and physiology was actually contingent on having the biology already, but I persuaded someone that I could do both at the same time. And it did pass, so apparently that was worth the gamble. It was the best. It was so good. We were in this anatomy and physiology class that was basically for medical students with a few extra people kind of thrown in, anatomists, physiologists, stuff like that, and learning about how the kidneys work and all the various mechanisms and stuff like that, and how muscles work and the physiological chemistry is not the right thing, but the kind of the reason that muscles contract and the chemical reasons that muscles contract and all of that stuff. And it was just, it was the most interesting thing. And if I hadn't been like almost halfway down the road to doing psychology at that point, it would have been really tempting to switch to something sort of much more medical and much more physiological, because it was just the business. But then later on, I got to learn about the brain as well. So I was kind of satisfied by that.
Wow. Yeah, mine was a bit different because, well, so I started this program in the history of ideas, but and Ah, this I have to tell you about this because in I mentioned Arnas, I mentioned him a couple of times, I believe, but he made a subject for the whole of the higher education or universities in Norway called Exfil, Examen Philosophicum.
Not the X-Files.
Have you heard about this?
No. What is it? And who does it happen to?
So everyone who wants to have a university degree has to do this, independent of a field or sort of program. And it is an introduction to philosophy and philosophy of science and history of science.
That's the most awesome prerequisite I've ever heard. That is lacking from pretty much every degree course I've ever heard about and every school curriculum. What a great thing. So what kind of thing?
So it's pretty much the whole of the history of philosophy. Condensed.
Mm.
But and this is partly the reason why Sophie's World got popular in Norway, because it was read as this supporting material.
Wow.
And Arnas also wrote some great introductions to philosophy, actually. But yeah, the challenge is that you often take this subject the first semester.
Right.
And not everyone is perhaps mature enough to sort of take it in.
Mm.
But it's probably good anyway.
It seems
to get a taste sort of the theoretical landscape.
Seems like a really helpful place to start. I agree with you about the maturity issue, but oh, what a good foundation. Wow. I've always wanted something, the kind of the psychology equivalent of that. Because I think it's kind of super important to understand things like cognitive biases and blah, blah, blah. People never get taught that. And it would be really helpful in life. Never mind your degree. What about life? To examine, information.
And I pretty much spent the university years discovering, I had that in Exfil.
Wow.
That was the thing. Okay. So, yeah, recommended. And yes, so I enrolled in those courses, and it was twofolded. It was the history of philosophy and logics. So deconstructing arguments and rhetorics and so on.
Mm.
But the lectures were so boring. I slept through most of them. They were pretty good on deconstructing arguments, so.
So here's my question, right? Because, yeah, you strike me as someone who's good at that. But were you good at that when you walked in? Because that's, if you're not naturally good at that, I'm not naturally good at that. It's quite a hard skill to learn.
I think so.
So you just had an easy ride. You just slept through the class and then sailed through the exam. All our listeners hate you, Knut. All our listeners now hate you.
I spent many years arguing with people.
What proportion of those arguments did you win?
It's not about the winning. It's about the participation.
So Norwegian. Except for the part where, like, if that was a winter sport, that would not be true.
It's still,
if you argue in the snow, is that a winter sport?
A winter sport is about the participation of winning. Anywho.
Anyhow.
I know, but... Yes, so I took that, and I think it was during that fall I decided, because my friends took the study of religion, so I decided, let's just do that first, because I had the opportunity to do that within my sort of curricula or program. And I did, and it was so fulfilling that I just stayed within the study of religion, and I switched program to a more open thing, where you could mix your own bag of a bachelor's. So I have a bachelor degree in culture and society.
Nice. I'm sure it's not the first time I've said this, but being able to do something that approximates a liberal arts degree is lacking largely in the UK. I think you can go and do sorts of similar things to what you just described, but you wouldn't have been able to pick up statistics or things like that on the side, I don't think. Maybe very early on, maybe superficially.
Yeah, because apart from the religion courses, I took sociology. And the methodology of sociology, that's where I first met statistics and the quantitative stuff. And I also took Sami religion. That was pretty fun.
Yeah.
The Scandinavian Area Studies program.
Wow, I bet that would be interesting.
And as I mentioned, our bachelor's degree is 3 years, but I also took a fourth year before master's.
You can do that?
Yeah.
Wait, sorry, you converted into a master's by doing an extra year straight away, or?
No. So the deal is that the state will give you a student's loan and a student's stipend for 8 years. So if you want, you can stay being a student in the university for 8 years.
That's a lot of years. And so you did an extra fourth year because you could.
Yeah, I didn't feel ready for diving into the master's because I went straight to university.
Oh, from school.
So many people, they will have a year where they do something else or serving in the military or something. So, yeah. I didn't have that, so I spent one more year studying.
Well, did you just choose some different subjects to add, or?
Watashi wa Nihongo benkyoshimashita. So I studied Japanese, and that was the hardest, most intense semester I ever had.
It's nice that everything is not a breeze for you.
I'm not a language person.
You're doing a commendable job in your second language right here.
But yeah. Anyhow. I also did... No, that was in my master's. Statistics.
Right.
For real.
Right.
So, yeah.
Lots of people who study psychology are very thrown when it becomes apparent that they have to learn how to do statistics, because it's not what people first think of when they think about studying psychology. They think about the mind, or they think about people's behavior or whatever. And it comes as quite a rude shock to many, many undergraduates that they actually have to become competent in statistics, because it's the kind of fundamental tool set that academic psychology works in. It depends, like I'm saying that, there are a lot of people working in academic psychology who use qualitative techniques, but the instrument that is used in teaching is pretty much all quantitative. So very shocking. In my undergraduate class, so I went to university to study psychology in the peak Cracker years. I don't know if you've ever seen the TV show Cracker with Robbie Coltrane. It was kind of big in the 90s. I suspect you're a little bit young for it. But it was this phenomenon in forensic psychology, and courses after that, courses in forensic psychology in the early 2000s kind of bloomed. Everybody wanted to be a forensic psychologist like Robbie Coltrane. But before that, hang on, how did I get here? Sorry, I just looped around on myself. but before that, psychology was often picked up as an easy subject. And it was until you got into any kind of rigor and methodology. And at that point, everyone fell by the wayside. So I was in an undergraduate psychology class in my first year of 900 people who had to be split between two lecture theatres, one of which had TV cameras relaying the lecture from the other one. Because lots of people picked it up as a kind of third throwaway subject, and a lot of people failed it. And this kept happening every year. There was this enormous attrition rate of people who didn't realise quite how much effort it was going to involve. It's not a soft subject, people. there is no such thing as a soft subject, but like it's not easy.
My way of looking at it is that every subject is soft.
In the sense of?
But you guys are just tricking yourself to believing it that it's not.
Right. You just got to bend your head in the right shape, right?
But, yeah, statistics is weird because I think it's much in the presentation of it. Because if you look at the maths, it's really not that difficult.
No.
It's mostly algorithmic means of algorithmic means.
Of algorithmic means, sorry. I agree. We had a terrible, terrible stats teacher for the year. I think it was my third year. They went really heavy on stats. And the teacher was awful. He was just really incapable of communicating the subject. And he wrote a lot on the blackboard, but he didn't explain it well at all. And towards the exam period, I sat down with one of my best friends and said, right, look, how does this work? And he explained it to me in half an hour. And I wrote, like, in my exam at that point, we weren't very reliant on a lot of software. And one of the things that we had to do or could do in the exam was generate, derive an ANOVA from first principles. And I could do that by the exam. Like, it's not that hard. But no one explains it like that. Also, no one does that in the exams anymore. Everyone just uses software. But hey.
Yeah. It seems that because statistics, I guess most of the concepts, and this is perhaps the feature of statistics, they are not intuitive. It's hard to wrap the head around it, especially the first times.
Right.
But yeah.
Where the rubber really meets the road is teaching statistics to undergrads. So that was one of the first things I got to do as a new lecturer. And actually, I did it my whole time as a lecturer, was teaching basic undergraduate statistics. It was really, really challenging for exactly the reasons you describe. People just find it really hard to get their heads around what is happening. And so you have to find kind of simple, elegant ways of explaining what's going on and why it's happening. It's hard.
Yeah, and I believe that this seems to be, and I guess this could be a psychology study, and I guess there are many of them, but there's a thing that people believe, I'm not a maths person, I will never understand this.
Right.
And if you come to this with this idea, you will never understand it.
Right.
So it requires you to be open or fearless or something. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's really hard when you're 19 and no one's ever taught maths well to you. I think it can be really challenging. And so that was one of the problems to work with, is okay, like how can we frame this in a way that is non-threatening?
I think I had the book Statistics Without Tears on my
right
on my list. Yeah.
When you applied to do a master's, what was it, and was it competitive? How did you get in?
The masters were not that competitive at the moment. It varies, but I had good grades at that time, so it wasn't that much of a problem. But yeah.
What was it a master's in?
The study of religion.
Okay, pretty broad.
Yeah. So to be more specific, I ended up writing a master's on the methodology of large-scale cross-cultural social service surveys, and how they operationalized religion and religiosity. So like the World Value Survey, the social survey program, and so on.
Is there like a kind of a lift, an elevator pitch version of the conclusion that you can give us? Is it like they all do it differently? It's a problem.
more research is needed. No, perhaps not surprising, but I found out that the way they measure and sort of maps religion is mostly a construction of American Christianity, which makes for some error-prone assumptions in the end. And also, at the moment, it has become better now, but the documentation for the methodologies was quite lacking. So I went through all the translations of all the questionnaires and the data and so on and so on.
How were people doing academic research without documenting it? Like, how does that work?
Well, it doesn't, I guess. But World Value Survey, it started in 1985. And I guess because we haven't, as a species, we haven't done this that long, sort of these kind of studies. And
right.
I guess they also have to find out of things. And yeah. So for example, a very concrete thing I found was, for example, in the translation of the questionnaire that was used in Hong Kong in 2005, I think, the English question, "Do you believe in God?" was translated into the Chinese equivalent to "Do you believe in religion?"
Whoa. Yeah.
And that may be, but not really be culturally sort of correct or a better way to ask it, but really not. But if it were, it is still a problem because the numbers, the statistics are translated back to "Do you believe in God?" and compared with other countries, right?
Right, where that's not really the question that was asked at all.
Yeah, lost in translation is a thing. And also just translating the words and concepts for God, that's difficult on a population level. How do you go to Japan and do that?
Yeah.
And so on. So So it was quite interesting.
Hmm.
And I also found that the theoretical underpinnings of how they made these questionnaires were from some work done in the 60s on American Christianity. So, yeah.
Right. Well, in psychology, most results ever seem to have been based on undergraduate psychology students. So similar limitations that apply.
And this is where the perhaps larger difference becomes lesser, because I also specialized in the cognitive study of religion.
Can you say a little bit about what that is? Because surely all study is inherently cognitive.
Well, it borrows from, or it is, or borrows from the psychology, the cognitive psychology, and some claim also neurology, but those kind of studies are not that good, or that kind of research. But it is to explore and try to find out how religious behavior and modes of thinking are possible with kind of brains and systems we have. But also the other way around, what religious behavior or thought, how that sort of what consequences it has in terms of cognition or and so on.
Hmm.
So it's a quite broad field. Hmm. You have everything from the how did we as during evolution evolve to be the kind of species that can have belief in gods, for example. what is the cognitive makeup of that, and
what's the physiological makeup of it, and so on, if you want to get into that,
and other things. What kind of implicit assumptions do we make during a ritual, for example, and so on? So yeah,
that seems like a huge topic.
Yeah, and it's pretty interesting theory. It's a sort of a generative theory on ritual behavior and cognition.
Is it viewed like, is the study of this stuff in a kind of cognitive framework, is that viewed negatively by people who are religious and who take place in who kind of do things that I'm going to loosely term as spiritual or religious, who, like, it's possible if you talk about this from a cognitive psychology point of view, certainly it's possible to make this very reductive and to say that religion is a series of cognitive frameworks, or like to view it very mechanistically. I don't know. Is that a problem for people who are actually sort of practicing religions, who find that that is a very reductive way of thinking about it?
Yes and no. Because, for example, if you say that the reason you experienced spirits or your dead grandma upstairs and so on, it's because of the human capability to assume agency around us, right? And so on. So your brain are made for sort of making the assumption that there's someone here,
right?
Agency and so on. But and this is challenging, at least from within the study of religion, because many of those who do research on the sort of the cognitive makeup of religion and so on, they are advocates of, for example, a religion or Christianity or something. One of the most active researchers are Catholic, who are interested to sort of, yeah. So it is science in a way. The methodology and sort of the reductive approach are there, but we are made like this. We are created with these kind of capabilities, right? So you can put a theological interpretation around it, sort of it turtles all the way down, kind of thing, right?
Right.
So yeah. So the smart ones, they manage to have two thoughts in the head at the same time, which seems impossible, really. But
well, as a agnostic / atheist, that's hard for me to fathom. But okay,
fathom.
We went down a theological / theoretical spiral a little bit.
But this was my world for many years. Almost 10 years. So it was partly these kind of things. And I geared more and more towards the cognitive and sort of the psychology of religion thing. But also, as I hinted at in my master's, the meta-theoretical stuff, how science is made, sort of, how it works.
Right.
To look back at ourselves and think about how we sort of produce knowledge and research.
That's pretty deep.
Or shallow, or whatever. For example, when I applied for a PhD fellowship, the way it works that you apply with a proposal for the project, and you weren't allowed to propose a project that was meta theoretical or dealt with the history of the science. It's
why not?
Kind of weird being the humanities, but
why?
I think it was to prevent people from being too
postmodern.
or to just do science on science, because there are sort of this stance that you should go out in the world and study real stuff. Quotation marks.
What's real stuff in this context? What does that even mean?
But the sort of the empirical stuff to map culture and write about quotation mark real people.
Is that because you should be doing that at the level of like doctoral study, and then if you want to go meta, then you can do that afterwards? But you need training in the kind of the groundwork, and you're going to get that from doing actual field work and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that's partly the reason.
Well, that sort of makes sense. Like, a lot of writing or studying for a PhD and then writing a thesis is really just about learning a set of skills, right? And some of those are analysis, and some of those are writing, and some of those are synthesis, and blah, blah, blah.
A very specific set of skills.
Very particular skills, like Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
Sadly, not actually Liam Neeson's skill set, which might have come in handy at some time in academia, but...
I think the archaeologists are pretty close. At least those who have to study in South Africa and so on.
Oh, I know what I was going to say about this. So I did a master's degree as well, but I didn't go straight from doing undergraduate to doing a master's. When I graduated in a class of 80 people, and fully half of those people had a degree that was quite decent caliber, or maybe just under half. But there were so many psychology graduates at that time. It was a very popular degree course, as I said. It didn't differentiate me in any way from anyone else. So I was a bit stuck. Like, I kind of wanted to go and carry on because I was really interested in neuropsychology and cognitive neuroscience and stuff like that. I couldn't really get a job. Like, not a psychology job. To get any job in psychology, you kind of increasingly you need more qualifications, you need experience. It's actually quite hard to get into. Once you're in, you're fine because you have some experience. And you need postgraduate training to do a job as a psychologist. So I went and did Russian for 9 months, not least because having whatever language ear I have, they gave me a scholarship. I can't remember how they tested it, but I was like, well, I have some Czech and I can do languages. And they gave me money to do it. That was nice. And then I worked for a year and a half in the real world. It was shit. It was really, really bad. I was doing an admin job and... it was okay. Like, I worked with people who were lovely, really, really nice, but the work was pretty tedious and menial. I had the world's worst boss. No, the world's second worst boss, as I later found out. So this boss was competent in bullying and micromanaging, but I later had a boss who was incompetent in bullying and micromanaging. And I sort of preferred the competent boss, but it's really hard to call it. They were both awful. I inherited this boss after a few months in the job. I inherited this new boss who was just dreadful, dreadful person, really horrible to me. And it made it such that, like, I probably should give her credit for actually putting me back in academia, because I was just like, well, if this is the world of work, I do not want this. I'm going to go back and study again, because that was great. And actually going back and being a student, at that point, technically a mature student, like I was in my mid-20s or whatever, it was awesome. It was like, oh man, I just get to learn all day. This is the best thing ever. I love being a master student.
So when you were a student, did you have work sort of along with that?
It was full time for a year.
Yeah, because I had to work...
For a job?
Well, yeah, I have to have sort of this part-time or not that... It wasn't that much, but I had to have some work along with the studies because the stipend alone wouldn't suffice my lifestyle.
kind of lavish lifestyle. We, you know, I'm sure it's very, very common. The only reason that I didn't have to do that actually was that I got a scholarship, a studentship from the Medical Research Council for that year. From the Biological and the BBSRC. I can't remember what the other B is. Biotechnology, maybe. I can't remember. Yeah. Again, I think just based on undergraduate academic grades or whatever compared to the other students, I think they just went, right, we have one funded place. And they give it to me. So yeah, that was nice. Huh.
But so I spent some hours in a month in the grocery store and so on. A couple of years in, he who became my supervisor, he recruited me as what could you call an assistant?
Yeah, like a lab assistant, I guess, research assistant.
But in the humanities, that is inserting references into an endnote.
Oh, so you just did the monkey work for the...
Oh, yeah. Oh, but wow. It was great.
It's nice to get paid for something kind of close to what you're doing, right?
It was. So the first... So I spent the summer just going through all these articles he has printed out and transcribing the references into EndNote and categorizing them.
Mm.
But after that, I got to do more research work, so preparing data for quantitative analysis and so on.
Cool.
And I also did some editorial stuff. So that was great.
That sounds cool.
Mm. And I got paid.
Also cool. You just reminded me, I worked in the university library as an undergraduate for a few hours a week. That was ace. Putting books back on the shelf in the right Dewey Decimal System order. You can see that might be the kind of work I would enjoy.
Yeah. And also being irritated that people had put the books in the wrong place.
Constantly. Right? Constantly.
Did you do a lot of hushing?
Oh, no. Very little. People behave pretty well, actually. People would sometimes come and ask. One of the things I realized about myself that I really liked was helping people for a living, because people would sometimes come and say, I can't find this section. Can you help me? And that was really nice to be able to help. But like,
so somewhere in your brain, there's a map of the library and the stacks.
Yep. I mean, they've probably moved it all around since, but...
Right. I guess there's loads of stuff to talk about when it comes to university.
Endless.
Yeah, it's a fascinating place.
It is. I think we're very ill-equipped to deal with the external view of it. I've spent so much of my life in universities. I really don't know how it looks from outside.
Yeah, I mean, that's not our job.
Yeah, I know. I wish we had that perspective here because... But maybe we're explaining it for people who didn't do that, I guess.
But I almost became nostalgic now, because the stuff we talk about, this was the happy years.
Right.
this was the kind of stuff that made university special, in a kind of way.
Definitely.
And also the feeling of being on the verge, being in sort of on the front lines of human knowledge in a certain field.
Yeah.
That's sort of, the new book comes out next month, and so on.
Yeah. It's nice to feel that you're finding stuff out that no one has really understood before, or that you're testing ideas that no one has really tested. It's extraordinary, actually.
Yeah, and following the arguments and discussions and,
Maybe more on that next time, a little bit, before we go over the cliff.
Also, I wrote aha moments, not as in the music group, but because as a student, you have these kind of, that's it. That's the thing. Sort of this... glimpses of something.
Fun fact, one of the PhD places I could have taken and didn't was actually to study the aha moment. I really, really, really wanted to study the neuroscience of the aha moment. And the only reason I didn't take that role, that position, was that it was funded by the defense industry. And I knew where that was going to go. I knew how the technology was going to end up being used, directly or indirectly, and I was not okay with it.
But being a teacher of statistics, you had the perfect lab environment. Or the least perfect.
Well, this was before. So the teaching stats came later, but the that PhD, like, I still, in a way, I still really regret not taking it, but I was uncomfortable with the ethics. So I couldn't do it. Which is a shame.
Cause also, it would be a nightmare to study the aha moment and constantly feel the pressure to have the aha moment.
Oneself.
Right?
Well, you know, those who can't research or something, how does that go?
It seems kind of recursive, that kind of study. Yeah, okay. So, but what I wanted to mention is, and this is an aha moment I want to not impose, but recommend for other people as well, that perhaps haven't done that much in university, or left before they got it. That's the, it's not me, it's them aha moment. So you spend at least half of the university years feeling stupid because you don't get stuff, right? You don't get the scribblings on the blackboard, and you don't get the conclusion in the textbook and so on. But it is perhaps because the people you read are bad writers.
I've got to say, there's an awful lot of that in academia. Even the work that you opened this episode with, right, there's a lot of dense words in there. That is hard going. I found it hard going. I'm out of practice of, like, listening and reading that kind of material. And I was like, I cannot hold the number of abstract concepts in my head that are going on here. So it's pretty relatable for, like, someone who's been in and out of the academy. It's like, this is dense. Yeah. So if you have that kind of experience of higher ed, I guess don't feel bad. It was just shit teaching.
Title.
Indeed.
Do we have to conclude? More research is needed.
There's always more research needed. How do you think universities get, like, money? It's a pyramid scheme.
The final chapter, the conclusion is always the most difficult.
Indeed.
What does this mean? What does this imply?
Right.
And not to make assumptions, but that it was. I think it's a slightly larger pressure to do that part well in humanities, compared to the more sciencey fields.
Because you're not testing a hypothesis always?
Yeah, that's... So the kind of stuff you leads up to the stroke of geniusness or something that has to happen in the last part. Because you spend a lot of time discussing the data and the previous research and the concepts and thought, and then you have to say something about what it means.
It's point two on the list, the kind of question mark or exclamation mark, and then three is profit, but it's that troublesome number two on the list.
And when I read stuff from lab research and STEM fields and so on, you have the presentation of the subject area, you have the methodologies, you have the data, you have the results, and you have some slight through paragraph on discussion where you can sort of throw out what the next research project should deal with or something. Perhaps I'm being a bit reductive now, but...
Well, that's kind of the shape of it. If you're doing quantitative analysis, it's going to come down to, we got a statistical result, now we're trying to interpret it, right? But there isn't that in the humanities sometimes. Sometimes, like, it just has to be genius, right? That's it. Yeah, that's a lot of pressure. I hadn't thought about that.
Hmm. And how I didn't deal with that pressure next time. should we do a quick follow-up? It has to be really quick,
okay,
though.
I want to talk briefly about Sophie's World, which I started reading.
Yeah. You did?
Well,
in Norwegian?
Fun fact, actually in Danish.
Okay.
Due to a series of, I feel, completely understandable human errors, which is to say that the title in Danish is the same as the title in Norwegian. And I was like, oh, great, they have it in iBooks or whatever. I'll buy it. So I'm now reading it in Danish.
And how does that work for you?
It's 85% fine. There are some things I have to think about a little bit, and there are some words that I don't know but can infer from context. And then a couple of words here and there where I'm just like, right, okay, I'm just going to have to let that one go and trust that it will become obvious. It's much, much easier than I thought it would be.
Cool.
It's good so far. It took me a long time to figure out it was in Danish. I was expecting the OE ligature, but it seems like they don't do that. So, anyway. But I was like, well, it's not Bokmål. It's not Nynorsk. This is Danish. They say off. It's got to be Danish. But it took me a long time to be sure about that.
Huh.
But it's cool. It reminded me that I had an equivalent read of Sophie's World when I was about the same age, which was A Wrinkle in Time. I don't know if you ever read it. By Madeleine Long. I don't know how you pronounce her name. Her surname is French, but she's, I think, an American author. And it was less mind-bending than Sophie's World, I think, by probably an order of magnitude. But it's this lovely prize-winning book. And one of the many things it does is it makes it okay to be a nerd. And it's actually kind of a thinly veiled Christian allegory, which I did not get at all in the same way that I did not get at all that the Narnia books were about Christianity until much later. But it was great. It had a nice sequel. I read it and reread it endlessly. And it's, I don't know, it makes one very curious about, it talks a lot about multidimensional things and travel. And it's got this sort of... time and space dimension MacGuffin, I guess, which is kind of really interesting. So maybe that was my, I think it was probably my way into science fiction, actually, and kind of generally interest in science. So I recommend, I don't know how well it stands up now. Probably not as well as Sophie's World, which seems to have been written for everybody.
That's a weird coincidence, actually, because... My word of the week, I chose that from yesterday's Apple keynote, which I watched for the first time in many years.
Live?
That was a dense keynote. So much stuff.
I haven't read any of the follow-up yet. I didn't.
We will get screen recording in iOS.
Ooh, finally.
That's a dream for a UX person.
Right.
Also, Siri will... now be capable to translate stuff on the fly.
Ooh.
And so on. And also understand some context and bring it sort of into the whole experience thing. And what Craig Federighi, he demoed this, and he asked Siri some questions about Iceland. And more specifically, Snæfellsnes.
Easy for you to say.
Pretty. But he also said it. And it was... I just picked it because it was a fun place name in Iceland. But when I checked it up on Wikipedia, I learned that this place... Mm-hmm. is featured in the Journey to the Center of the Earth by Jules Verne. That's how you pronounce it, right?
Jules Verne, I think.
Jules Verne.
Or something.
And he is my introduction to science fiction.
Hmm. Traditional. I like it.
Hmm.
Should talk.
Because, I think mainly because of the radio plays, which aired in Norway. Hmm. But yeah.
Nice.
So there we have it. yeah. I also have a cultural pick of the week, but did you have a word?
I do not. I'm playing your card this week. I do not have a word of the week.
That's okay. That's perfectly fine.
The dog ate my homework.
I have a cultural pick of the week. I tried for the book among the books that were most influential for me in university. And there are many, but I think for this episode I will choose In Gods We Trust by Scott Atran.
Okay.
And if you are interested sort of in the sort of cognitive look at religion, this is a good starter, I think. It's also quite... it's almost a popular science book. It's quite... It's not dense, but it's there's much there. It's much to swallow.
Mm.
And because he tried to make this sort of unified theory. And I guess there's much in there that doesn't necessarily hold water, or we have learned more since it came out. But
when was it published?
2002. Mm. So... the evolutionary landscape of religion. But I think the perspective or the kind of way he thinks about evolution and culture is a good way to think about it. Also, Scott Atran is... he has done his field work, to say the least. He has done field work among... suicide bombers and so on. So he knows his stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
Goodness.
So that's an interesting book you can pick up.
No kidding. You've reminded me of a thing that I should make my cultural pick of the week, which is a lovely book by Stephen Rose called The Making of Memory. And he just describes what it's like to research human memory. And he talks quite a lot about animal studies of the kind where chickens peck at coloured beads and learn to peck at different coloured beads and so on, but looking for a biological basis for it and looking for the underpinnings of memory. And he talks about the whole field. He talks about his own, it's kind of anchored in his own research. It's extremely accessible, really well written, very interesting. And I read it, I think, as an undergraduate, well before I was actually serious about studying sort of neurobiology and things like that. And it's super interesting. And it seems, I think it's now available in sort of an updated edition. I'm sure it's very different from the one I originally read because so much has happened in neuroscience since then. So, so much. This says 2003 on Amazon. And I think when I read it, it was probably, the issue that I read was probably comfortably 10 years older than that. 1993, it says the first edition came out. Yeah. Anyway, definitely recommended. Just, I don't know, like... I think it's quite hard for people to understand what academic researchers do all day. And there is this kind of boffin in the lab coat stereotype, which I both love and hate. There's a romanticism about the idea that you kind of sit in a lab having brilliant ideas. Actually, the truth is much more like how I spent most of my, well, a big chunk of my PhD, which is writing down brain coordinates to map them in a brain atlas. Now there is a lot more software that would do this. No?
No, they're spending their time, all the time, writing...
grant applications.
Yeah. And that's not funny, because it's true.
I know. It's funny because it's true, and it's not funny because it's true. Yeah. All right, that's next week's episode.
All right. This was a short one. I guess we also have an After Dark where we discuss all the new iPods and iPads and iOSs and macOSs and the HomePod.
Okay, I need to get on the internet. I have seen
Siri
nothing.
Siri in on a speaker.
I looked at Twitter this morning and I missed, like, no one was talking about last night's WWDC. Everyone was talking about, like, politics, which I feel is sort of progress in a way, but I just wanted someone to sum it up for me and no one could.
Well, my Twitter feed wasn't like that. So I guess you have, I don't know, who do you follow? Can we read the list on air? No.
It would take a little while.
I also think that we perhaps should make a kind of a small differences curricula for the small differences school of higher education.
Oh, I like that. Nice. With a reading list and yeah, that's cool. We should do that.
And we'll offer classes in a while.
Right.
Ha det bra. Takk for at du hørte på. Oh, wait a minute.
Wait, what?
The stuff.
What stuff?
Where can people find the stuff?
The stuff.
The links.
Yes. If you go to smalldifferences.fireside.fm, you will find all the stuff, including, if we get it online, some kind of curriculum, I guess, and a reading list.
Yeah.
Cool.
For
good
the summer.
Catch. You want to try signing off again? Professional podcasters.
My ritualistic behavior says that I cannot say it once more, that it won't be effective.
If you turn in a circle 3 times and repeat it, it's cool.
Okay, takk for at du hørte på. Ha det bra.
Takk for at du hørte på.